This is tape number 2 of Dr. Stephen Wright. Now, where were we?
Well, you're going to ask me a new question, I think.
And now I've forgotten what it was.
Well, we were talking, as you may recall, about the extent to which there is going to continue to be identity and identity among Negroes in this country.
Yes. My question was this. That over and over again, one reads and hears that the cutting edge of the present movement is based on a new conception of the self as Negro. If that is true, how do we square that with the prospect of the loss of this identity, this new image of the Negro's self? As Negro?
Well, in the first place, I don't believe in a new Negro with an image as Negro. Therefore, I have no problem in reconciling these two views.
But some Negroes do report this as their own feelings or as a sociological observation or a psychological observation. Some sociologists say this, some journalists say it. Some people said about themselves. Let me give you an example.
All right, I suppose you do.
All right, I was at Howard's, I told you, in November. There's a young woman whose name is Wheeler. She's a Phi Beta Kappa. She's a vital person, a fine orator. I heard her make a talk. This young lady, I can't remember my first name, came on before 1,500 people. Now, her complexion is as light as mine, close to it. I was sitting halfway back in the auditorium. Mm-hmm. And this was the drama of it. Here's this.
I have the.
Are we sounding here?
You give me an example.
All right. She was in the auditorium.
I caught the picture.
Calm there. I said, I have a great joy. I have a discovery to report to you. I have a great joy. I am black. And she said, you look at you and you and you. Your face is this color, this color pointing around. But your hearts are white. Your minds are white. You've been whitewashed. You are not black. You don't have my joy. This brought down the house.
This surprises me to some degree.
It swept it like a brush fire, you know.
Yes. But I don't believe the daily actions of these people who responded to that would support the joy. And you watch every action. I think if there were to be, to say it a different way, there is more tendency toward being involved in it than there is any other single thing I can think of, from dress to mannerism.
Yeah. Record here. You say you're going to Peru next week?
Yes, I am. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Institute of International Education.
Yes, I read that.
And I'm one of the delegates to the Council on Higher Education of the American Republics, which will be meeting in Peru from February 23rd to February 29th, it is this year. And
quite a leap year, isn't it?
That's right, and I'm looking forward to this with a great deal of enthusiasm.
That must be fascinating.
It'll be my first opportunity to visit Peru and to see something, I hope, of the remains of the civilization of the Incas.
Yes.
But I mustn't take your time for this personal.
I want some personal things before we stop. I want to come back to the matters of personal experience and personal history, if we may. But to cut back to the question of the identity as Negro, that is a problem, apparently, for some people, and a thing reported on, as you well know, by psychologists and sociologists.
Oh, yes.
And it's a It's a key question.
Let me make one other comment on it.
Please do.
It is unreasonable, I think, for children to be born in a culture who are exposed to its every aspect, who have very little of their own, to become anything other than a product of that culture. There isn't enough by way of studied devices, techniques, and teachings resident in the culture which we are part for any long period of time, in my judgment, to maintain the identity of Negroes as Negroes. Now, I'm mindful of the fact that so long as color is a factor in this country, that there will be some things which set people apart, but there will that will never, I think, be regarded as anything except a barrier to participation in the culture.
The color is a barrier.
That's right. The culture makes this makes what is striven for, in the example you give, I think impossible.
I find something appalling in a way, when I think of the whole world being exactly alike in all ways. I mean, small differences and big differences that give interest to life. Like differences in all personalities. We're not robots. How to square this desire for variety of all sorts in life, the enrichment of life in variety, with a concept of the evening out. How to have a world where the varieties are there without the varieties being invidious in any way, and giving perfect freedom for personal preferences of all sorts. I suppose once you have perfect freedom for personal preferences, you move towards some wiping out of varieties anyway.
Mr. Warren, this doesn't bother me. I want to tell you why. In the first place, there are different cultures in the world.
Yes.
That do, as a matter of fact, produce people with very different outlooks on life and very different sets of values. The children who are reared in those kinds of cultures are going to inevitably be different from children reared and educated in a culture like the one of which we are a part. That's one thing. And then there is a concept that John Dewey had, with which I completely concur. And it is that no environment is identical for any two people.
Even in the same family.
Even in the same family. Now, there is one other little thing that is consistent, I think, with the thing which I think lies at the basis of all that we are saying here. And that is that to the extent that this world becomes a one world, with instant communication,
yes,
in the finest meaning of the term, will differences in the world tend to decrease. But this, in my own view, is a very long way off.
It's a long way off. There'll still be plenty of variety in my time.
That's right.
Anyway.
And in mine.
In fact, there'd be too much variety of a certain kind.
That's right.
No, I was not concealing an argument for defense of the race. That isn't my point at all.
Right.
Because
no, I didn't. I certainly didn't mean to react to it.
I don't think you did. I just wanted to put that up, just make that specific.
Right.
But that's not the point, because on that matter, I think that's every man's personal question of how he leads his private life. I don't think people interfere. Any man's private life. He can do what he wants to. If two people want to get married, that's their business and not mine.
Right.
Totally. I mean, this is
my own view.
Oh, the basis of all of human individuality and human liberty. Just that's. So I'm anything on that side, I'm completely against any interference with personal preferences for association and marriage and anything else.
I feel the same way.
That's an infringement of basic liberty.
Right.
For instance, in Jackson, Tennessee, Mississippi, when I discovered I can't ride in a taxi cab with a Negro without being pulled out by the police and fined for my having ridden him in a taxi cab. That's not a question of any ideas, a question of infringement on my personal liberties. Personal liberties,
that's
you
right.
See.
You're absolutely correct.
That's what I'm asking. It's my liberties that are being attacked.
That's right.
Not the Negro man's liberties in the cab with me. I mean, this is...
His liberty.
His big attack, too. But that's mine I'm concerned with. That,
that's right.
And that's right. Your first reaction to defend your own.
That's right. I agree.
And I believe this is the key of the whole business. But the white man is penalized by certain systems as well as the black man.
This is an inevitable consequence.
And that, I think, is really the way to go at hitting this thing in a way. The white man's being penalized.
Well, he certainly is.
Sure is being penalized. So is the society. Let's change the subject to something else for a moment. We were talking earlier about social process. You talked about the time element in social process of all kinds. This means time. I find that when the time element is mentioned, I sometimes encounter terrific resistance, sometimes overt, sometimes hidden, to the concept of time in the process. For instance, I read a quotation from a Negro historian on the question of civil rights, and he says this is a matter of a social process. And there's no absolute or immediate solution ever to a social problem. No absolute and immediate solution.
He's correct.
I read this to a...
Sounds like a sociologist, though.
Yes, a very brilliant young Negro student the other day. Very brilliant guy. And I said, what do you think of that? He said, "Quite." For God's sake. This is all going to pieces. Maybe.
It may not.
Let me see if you say something indirectly.
I'm going to speak in just a moment or two about the question you just raised.
Are you working?
No, we're not working. Are we working? Are we working? Hope for the best now. Well, where were we again?
I'll try not to be so windy in the responses.
No, that's not the point at all. It's going fine.
See,
it's a question of the young man who said, but I can't bring myself to say it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're here against the tension between the idea of social process, historical process, and the notion of freedom now. How do we put these two things together?
I think this is the real problem. There has been so much said and done with respect to the whole question of rights as related to Negroes about there being sufficient time and encouragement to look forward to its ultimate solution without any real reference to any program to get it done, that there is an impatience with anybody who says that this will take time. It has been associated in my own mind with an intention to do nothing. I think there isn't a student of a problem in the world who doesn't realize that it is going to take time. But there is one other thing that I think is a part of the strategy, and that is, in order to get anything moving, you have got to have a now approach to it. But this is a starting situation, and not, in my own opinion, any illusion, or engaging in any illusion, that what is hoped for is going to occur next Thursday. I did my opening address for our convocation this fall, I spoke on a topic that I call Beyond the March on Washington, in which the very point that I'm making now was made in trying to call the attention of the students to the fact that the problems that confronted the group as Negroes were going to take a long time and a great deal of work on the part of very many people, including them, because certain of the things were not going to happen in our lifetimes.
I wonder what relevance this has. I was acquainted once with some Italian partisans just after the war. Life had become nothing for them because that was over. Is there much of a danger, you think, of the young Negro who's committed deeply to this? 5 years from now, 10 years from now, his vocation is over. Do you see the possibility of some casualties there?
Only for those who are making the civil rights movement a career. And I don't think any organization in this area ought to make the perpetuation of the organization and the career the object of the effort. It is the thing which the organization seeks to achieve. For the overwhelming majority of these youngsters, I see no real danger because they will go about their life's work. I think they will be more sensitive citizens. They will know when a problem is important, I think, a great deal better than they would have known before, that they will tend to be more active in the political processes, in the community efforts to get things done. But I don't believe that this is going to provide any problem for the overwhelming majority of students.
Just for the few casualties that are bound to occur in any battle
of
the sort.
Right.
Do you remember, either in your life or in reading about it, the opposition to the appointment of Judge Parker to the Supreme Court by Hoover? He was. I've read this was a great watershed case in organizing Negro political pressure.
Correct.
The first time it was ever effective. If it was effective, Judge Parker was not confirmed. The attack on Judge Parker was that, as a Southerner, he would not be an impartial judge.
I remember the case.
Well,
I'm just reading about it. I'm older.
You remember that? Oh, you're old enough to remember it. I wouldn't have thought
absolutely.
That. Well, anyway, subsequent events apparently prove that he was a very impartial and decent judge, decent
that
man.
That is absolutely correct.
Now, again, with Justice with Black.
Has been one of the most able jurists the court has ever had.
But there was a vast amount of opposition to him on the grounds. He's from Alabama. He's a Ku Kluxer.
Right. I remember that case.
Now, those are stereotypes that are on the part of Negroes and on the part of certain white people who are of liberal views. Do you think now, given such a case, man from Alabama, man from Mississippi, on the Supreme Bench, you'd have this automatic stereotype response?
No, I don't think so. I think there'll be a tendency now to look at the man's record. For instance, I think that there's going to be a great deal of Negro support for President Johnson. I certainly intend to vote for him. And not only intend to vote for him, but intend to work for him within the limits of my little time and to make my little financial contribution to his campaign. I think that there are many Southerners who have demonstrated beyond any question that they can be as impartial and as fair as any human being. And I think the thing that I wish for myself, as much as I wish for anything in the world, is to be treated as a man and as an individual. And this I hope for other people as well as for myself. And I think this is becoming to be a very real part of the Negro attitude.
There's been a real advance in destroying, then, the Negro's stereotype of the white man and the white Southerner. even in the present moment of this friction and struggle.
There's no question in my mind. For example, I think that Keith Offer in Tennessee could run for any office had he lived.
Yes. And had the Negro vote.
And had a large part of the Negro vote. He would have certainly had the Negro vote in Tennessee.
Yes.
And much of the South.
Well, speaking of stereotypes, we all know pretty well what the white stereotype of the Negro is. How would you describe the Negro stereotype of the white man? Forgetting Southern white, but just white men in general.
That's too big.
Too big?
Too big. I think the Negro tends, I better say tended,
yes,
is a more accurate way to put it, to divide white people generally into two classes. Southern whites, Northern whites. This was naive, I might also add, because some of the most prejudiced human beings I've ever encountered were Northerners, and some of the most liberal men I've ever encountered were Southerners. I think that the stereotype of a white Southerner was one who not only thought of Negroes as being inferior, but who was prepared to support that by any ways and means at his disposal. The inner conflict reflected this, as you asked the question of Negroes back in 1955, 56, when you... I think this was in capsule form, the picture where the Southern white person was concerned. I think he thought, secondly, that the Northerner, while not willing to be that devoted to the segregation principle, was a great deal more liberal person merely by virtue of the place in which he was born and reared. But that didn't keep the Negro from having some reservation about the overwhelming majority of white people, irrespective of their place of birth. But there was a vast difference in degree. This would be roughly my answer to
it. I was talking the other day to a very prominent lawyer in a southern city, a Negro, high intelligence and good education, fine education. He's been very active as an attorney for one of the organizations that goes in for nonviolence. It's identified with that. He said to me, despite everything, I find myself drifting toward the position where no white man seems redeemable. There might be some individual here and there, but they're not to be redeemed. They are, he said, I'm almost a black Muslim. I'm actually reading their literature now.
That is nonsense.
He said, I'm forced this by my experience in the South in the last few years. He says,
well,
against my principles and against my human values, but said, I'm forced, being forced into it.
Well, my own experience.
It's shocking to me.
Yes, my own experience is very different, Mr. Warren. And I don't want this to sound holier than thou, so I'm going to take just a second to tell you just a little bit about my own background.
I wish you would.
I grew up having been reared in the main by a grandmother who had been a slave, who had a basic distrust for most white people. I remember one of the things that she told us children on many occasions, feed all white people with a long spoon. Keep them out of your business. Be polite to them, but stay out of their way. I don't expect you to to bow and scrape, but this is the way our family, in essence, has lived and survived. I went to Hampton Institute for high school because there wasn't a public high school for Negroes in 150 miles away. I finished elementary school.
Where was that?
It's in Vance County, North Carolina. And my teachers in that school, in the academy at Hampton Institute, with a few exceptions, were all white New England teachers. My first real face-to-face contact on a day-by-day basis with people who were, beyond any question, interested in my welfare and my future, and who did everything they knew to do to inspire me to be a man, to develop good character, to be a good student, and to aspire for a career of service. And they themselves, in most of the instances, demonstrated what they were talking about themselves. I'm sitting here now in the office of the president of Fisk University, which is a product of that same kind of concern. And I know that almost every one of the major institutions for Negroes, I'm speaking of the private ones, were built by people who believe this. I worked with them. I worked with them here. This is an interracial faculty. Our board is interracial. Many of my friends, and this sounds like the old thing that we hear so much, but I know numbers of white persons as individuals. I expect to continue. Nothing that has happened in these 4 years has shaken my faith. On the contrary, it has confirmed it. And I think that I could document it if it were necessary. The very fact that so much has been desegregated in the South, the very fact that the Southerners didn't really put up a fight against the Civil Rights Bill in the House, not really, is in part an admission that they couldn't do anything about it, but I think it also represents, as one of the men said on television the other day, that this is a time to look at this problem dispassionately. If I assume for one moment that all white people needed to be put in this category, I couldn't say one blessed word if all white people put me in the same category.
That isn't the view Adam Clayton Powell took about the NAACP and Jack Greenberg, is it?
No. I worked with Jack Greenberg,
yes,
in one case as one of his expert witnesses.
You did?
And I was one who wrote him a letter and said that I thought he was a superb choice to succeed Thurgood Marshall. I still think so. He's an able lawyer, and if the NAACP is going to be successful, it's going to involve people of both groups, not in any aspect, but if the aspirations that the Negro minority in this country have are going to be realized, it's going to be realized because the people get concerned, not merely Negroes.
In Mississippi, I was told by several working with the civil rights movement, Negroes, these are all, that there had been real difficulty in getting acceptance of white volunteer workers who came to work with the Negro groups in Mississippi. But they'd had to be very delicate about this. So there were several factors flowed into it. One, the command post, the Fugitive Season Command Post, and another, ordinary envies or jealousies, not of power, but the...
It could be power.
Sometimes power.
Right.
Succeeding command post. I'm saying beyond that. Mm-hmm. Simply a human envy. This man comes, he can go again when he wants to. I'm stuck. Envy of his mobility.
I know.
Another thing, that the attempt of... some of these young whites, college students, or slightly above that age, who have fallen in love with the idea of entering into the Negro world, who want to appropriate a language, certain attitudes, which are supposed to be Negro, you see. But just the language of jazz, the language of certain exclusive, supposedly exclusive Negro expressions.
Mm-hmm.
And this has created a real resistance and a contempt. These are fakes. What do they try to move in onto this culture for? A real resistance. And Robert Moses told me, he said, well, you have a man said to blow off at a table in a conference right in front of, say, two of these people. Say, 15 minutes of blind ranting. And we took his, then let him blow it off, he'll recover from it.
Yeah.
But he said there's a real problem. And
I don't know how widespread the problem is.
I wonder if you encountered that here. That's what I'm getting
to
at.
The best of my knowledge, no. The movement here hasn't had a whole lot of white youngsters in it, but it's had some. For instance, Fisk University has been a host for busloads of them.
Yes,
come here,
yes.
And march, and participate. The kids are welcome with open arms. Fisk is a little bit different, perhaps, in this area because this is a part of its tradition.
It's a longer tradition and a longer exposure to this sort of relationship.
That's right. For instance, we've had an exchange program with 15 or 18 other kids on a semester basis for years. And there are 17 young white persons on our student body right now from other colleges. And we have more demand for this than we can supply matching numbers. So that our youngsters definitely have not taken this view. I remember one young man whose name I wish I could think of now, who was the most, perhaps the most respected demonstrator among all of the demonstrators, because his courage was beyond any kind of question, and his devotion to the cause was beyond any kind of question. And the kids adored him. We had one youngster to be beaten badly in that Alabama situation.
Yes, down there. He was badly hurt too, wasn't he?
I don't think Lewis was badly hurt, but this young white boy was seriously beaten. I tried to get him not to go.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I tried to intervene and keep him from going. He said in so many words, I made my will. I better not say this.
Right. You can cut anything off the record any way you want.
Right, because I may not get a chance to see this tape,
right.
And you're free.
All right,
you
all right.
Use the tape.
All right, I see.
But he said, I made up my will before I left here. I know that I'm going to run into difficulty. I think I will. And he went. And I didn't want the relationship between Fisk and Beloit College or his parents to be one of bitterness towards Fisk University. Right.
I suppose the difference between Mississippi, say, and Nashville is simply the longer exposure. You have a different tradition.
The difference may go deeper than that.
Tell me how.
First of all, the educational level in the two states, I think, differs markedly. Tennessee has never been, I don't think, I'm excluding two Western counties from this. First of all, it's been a more highly industrialized, a more highly metropolitanized state. It has had very many more institutions of higher learning in it. The level of education, I think, has had a lot to do with this. Its political leaders, and I don't know whether this is an accident or not, you'd know more about it than I, have not in the main built their total careers on the segregation issue as has been the case so often with Mississippi politicians. And you cannot preach the hatred and the segregation in the sense campaign after campaign after campaign to semi-literate people and expect a lot of them not to believe it. They do. Now, there have been very few campaigns in recent years in the state of Tennessee, for example, waged on this issue. The last one that involved the issue was the senatorial campaign. It involved Kefauver and Tip Taylor. And Taylor was decisively beaten, even beaten in Memphis, from which he comes. This is another thing that has a kind of spillover effect. It's not a very good explanation, but the difference, I think, is serious and significant.
The Press Scimitar the other day came out with a strong editorial supporting the Civil Rights Bill. Very strong editorial. After it had been passed in the House, it said it must be passed in the Senate now without delay, or there'll be, you know, very bad trouble. This is a mandate from the people of the United States, and it's got to be done now. This from the Memphis paper. Some people say, well, there's a local politics behind this. Maybe there is. But does this mark, in any case, some change?
Oh, yes. I think perhaps 10 years ago this would not have been written.
Would not have been possible.
Would not have been possible. But there is a great political change going on in Mississippi, I mean, in Tennessee, as you know, and in Memphis particularly.
Now, you mean the young Negro lawyers who are active in politics there?
I mean more than that. Take Tennessee as a whole, for instance. Some 64% of the eligible Negro voters are registered in Tennessee. And
as opposed to three in Mississippi or something like that?
Certainly the figure's low. I did know it.
Four, maybe, or five, but it's low.
Six, something of that sort. But politicians cannot ignore this. It's a major factor. The fact that Sugarman, for example, ran for the council in Memphis only dramatized the potentiality that lies here and the inevitability of the participation in the political processes in the state. Also, I think there is enough statesmanship on the part of the editors in a number of Tennessee papers to see that anything else is short-sighted policy. Tennessee is going to be a state, I'm convinced, is not Tennessee politics for me either. A state where industry can come with assurance that there's going to be racial peace and people who are at the power structure of the state and in these various cities who are going to build good schools, have good relations between the racial groups and the minorities. In other words, a healthy atmosphere. And I think this pays off for the entire state. There are people in our state who know this.
Well, clearly nobody's going to go to Jackson, Mississippi to build a big factory right now.
If they do, I think the judgment should be questioned.
They should be locked up. Be certified. Have you noticed any anti-Semitism among Negroes in Nashville?
I have not.
It's true in some places, of course. It varies spotty, but it's true in some places.
It's
true in Harlem, for instance.
I can see why there would be in sections of Harlem, but I've encountered none. We have had, over the years I've been here, three Jewish members on our board.
Yes.
Highly respected citizens in this community. One Jew ran for our present city council, and I know he got a substantial number of Negro votes because he's highly respected as a man. The fact that he's Jewish has nothing to do with it.
Of course, it's a strange thing. The Jews have been, by and large, liberals in their effect on society, and have actually been philanthropists who have given money to civil rights causes, Negro and white. At the same time, you have this huge split of intense anti-Semitism in some localities.
That's right.
It's Philadelphia, for instance.
Well, I can understand Harlem. Many of the landlords are Jewish.
Yes.
And they own a lot of the business in Harlem. And the Negroes hate landlords. I don't care what color they are.
Yeah.
Particularly in a situation like New York, for all its problems. I don't know as much about New York as I know about Nashville, naturally, although I go to New York frequently.
I was talking to bright, brilliant young woman, I guess you would say, who was a law student in a good law school and second in her class in her senior year. She's a Negro. She and I were having lunch. She started our conversation by saying, I have great hope for the arrangement in the South, of finding some life here after this crisis has passed, a real relationship with the Southern whites, a decent settlement. She said, I was born and raised on a farm in Virginia, and I've lived in several parts of the South, and I've been in a lot of Southern jails in recent years. For demonstrating that I still have, feel we are on the verge of some sort of reasonable community. Community.
I share her view.
She said, but I'm really frightened as far as the great northern city is concerned, where there's no human recognition that she says that she can find. And he, even here, there's a human recognition even when it's at the point of a gun.
I won't go that far.
Well, just after that, there's a possibility of a human recognition.
Expect more explosiveness in northern cities than there has been in the southern region, and I'm not sure that I know the reason for it. I know the explosive, a little bit about the explosive situation in Chicago, Detroit, and the riots that have occurred there. It remains for me to see, or I have to see, how rapidly the northern section of the country will respond to the problems that are created before I can make a judgment. Now, I watched the response of the New York City Board of Education to the de facto segregation situation.
Yes, please talk about that.
Some of the seem to be responsive to the problem, but that problem in my mind is not serious as the problems which give rise to it. One of them is segregation in housing, which is the problem.
Behind the school problem.
Behind the school problem. And the other is employment, or put it more accurately, unemployment, which throws into the streets of cities like Detroit and Chicago and New York large numbers, as Conant pointed out so well in his book, unemployed and in a sense unemployable young Negroes. It is going to be difficult for anybody, I think, to assess what this group is going to be capable of, because it's a frustrated, disappointed, bitter group of young people. And I think when I use the term responsiveness to, there's got to be, I think, a fairer approach to the employment opportunities that are there. There's got to be, I think, a breakdown of the segregated housing pattern. When this has begun, when these two things should have been attacked, the de facto segregation where school is concerned becomes an academic matter, as you know. I'm not by any means sure that the method of dealing with the problem is to bus youngsters from one community to the other.
You can't do it in Washington anyway.
Right. My feeling is that the job is to build in each of these communities a school that recognizes at the outset that they're dealing with a problem different from a problem involved in educating middle-class white youngsters. I've seen some of these schools. They're terribly overcrowded. Some of the teachers are bitter by virtue of the fact that they're assigned there in the first instance. I've seen textbook problems that are disgrace. I have seen a lack of guidance and counseling in these schools that was sensitive to the problems of these youngsters. I've seen some of the poorest teaching I've seen done in situations like this. If you start from the assumption, I don't care what the minority group is, that this is a group that is culturally deprived, you can't assign teachers on the same 30-to-1 basis, whatever it is your formula is. It's got to be in terms of enough people to get a job done if these people are going to be anything but dragged upon the economic system on which this country is built. That's enough. I've talked too long.
I've never found Methodist going to do much good. Some Negroes in the North have told me, but they regard this merely as a tactic, a pressure tactic, and not as a solution. A way of dramatizing a problem.
Yes, but I think one of the things that ought to accompany every pressure tactic is a clear goal. If you disagree with what is now being done, what is the proposal that you're struggling for? This ought to be made articulate, it seems to me, so that everybody understands what the objective is. Because how else can you elicit, enlist the support of people who, if they understood it, could come to your rescue and your help?
Well, some people say that the bus tactic is anything a great deal of support. Because it doesn't you. I must go.
I know you've overstayed your lunch.
I haven't overstayed my lunch. But I wish I could stay here for the lunch you offer me. This is the end of the conversation with Dr. Stephen Wright, February 15th, 1963.